You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Americans have been fearful of a lot over the years, and that's helped create a society that puts a premium on security and personal protection. We'll talk with a historian who says fear has shaped our lives from the Cold War to today. First, Republicans were celebrating yesterday when their tax plan passed Congress. The bill is headed for President Trump's desk, where he is expected to sign it into law early next year. It's the biggest tax overhaul in decades and a big legislative win for the GOP. But the plan is unpopular among the general public, according to recent surveys, and Democrats are hoping it will help them out in the 2018 midterm elections. Here's Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Republicans will rue the day they pass this bill, and you can bet Democrats will make sure of that. We are going to continue to hammer away at why this bill is so unpopular, at why what the Republican rhetoric and the reality is so far apart. Today's passage of the partisan tax bill officially cements the Republican Party as the party of the wealthy and the party of big corporations.
Paul Nolet is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. He's with us to take a closer look at what the tax plan means for Republicans and Democrats and next year's election campaign. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hi, great to talk with you.
Well, we just heard it there from Chuck Schumer. It sounds like the Democratic game plan based on this tax bill, they haven't mapped out already.
Yes, I think they have, and so far it's been quite successful. As you mentioned, the tax plan is very unpopular right now, and really I think many Americans who are giving their opinions about the tax plan are saying, well, we think that this is a tax cut for the wealthy, and that's where the money is going, very much mirroring what Democrats are saying about it. So far, the Democrats, like Chuck Schumer, have been successful in framing it in that way.
And Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin has become the face of the tax plan in many ways. And he said, yeah, that's out there, but there are a lot of misconceptions about it. Here he is on ABC's Good Morning America yesterday.
When people actually see that instead of getting tax increases, they're getting a tax cut, when they see the withholding tables changing in February and seeing more money in their paychecks, when they're seeing the economic growth that will result from historic tax reform, I think minds are going to change, and I think people are going to change their view on this. But they've been hit on TV with so many different confusing messages that there's no wonder there's a little confusion surrounding this.
And that's been an argument from some Republicans and some media analysts on this, Paul, that most people will, at least in the short run, get a tax cut. This will become more popular over time. What do you make of that?
Well, it's possible, and it's interesting because there's two different narratives you can have about this tax bill, both which use the percentage 80%, actually. So Democrats are going to point out, well, about 80% of the tax cut benefits go to the wealthiest Americans, the wealthy 1%, just in terms of the pure amount of dollars. Republicans, like Paul Ryan, are going to emphasize the fact that, well, about 80% of Americans will see some sort of tax cut once this rolls into effect. And so I think from Paul Ryan's perspective, he's hoping that people look at this tax cut, and even if it's relatively modest, it'll be still more money in their pocket. And there's some truth to looking at previous tax cuts, like the big tax cut at the beginning of the George W. Bush administration, that really Americans are willing to accept a tax cut as long as they see something, even if more of the benefits go to the wealthiest Americans. So I think there is a possibility, at least, that the tax plan could get more popular over time.
And both of those statements you made, the Democratic argument and the Republican argument, are each true. I mean, they each have some factual basis in them, right?
Yes, and that's the thing. And so, I mean, the clip that you just had from Paul Ryan, he says, well, there's a lot of confusing messages out there. But the thing is that both of those 80% messages are, in fact, both true. So far, the Democrats have had a lot more success in framing the tax plan around the idea that it generally goes to benefit wealthier Americans.
And then Democrats are also looking at making the case that, hey, the corporate tax cuts are forever or until changed. Some of the higher end tax cuts as well. A lot of the individual tax cuts have a sunset. They last 10 years and they would either expire or have to be renewed. Is that something that you think it's a little more of a subtle argument? Is that something they can make a case for, though?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Democrats are going to bring that up to say, well, you know, by 2027, your tax cuts will disappear. But it's always a more difficult argument to say, well, 10 years from now, something will happen. Because after all, Congress and many Republicans have made this argument that that Congress sometime in the next 10 years will extend the tax cuts beyond 2027. So I think that argument is going to be part of what Democrats say about the bill. But I think the big argument that they're going to make, and one that, again, has already been successful, is saying, well, hey, if we were doing tax reform and tax cuts, we'd have more of those benefits going towards working class and middle class Americans than the Republican tax bill is.
We're talking to Paul Nolet from Marquette University, looking at the political fallout from the tax overhaul plan that just passed in Congress, waiting for a signature from the president. And Paul, one big question people are asking is, you know, you've got the fundamentals of the election out there, generic Democrats outpolling generic Republicans in congressional races by a pretty wide margin, a president with a low approval rating. Does this tax plan just passed make a difference given all that?
I think it's going to be part of the conversation in the campaign for the House and the Senate in the lead up to 2018 for sure. However, I don't think it's going to make a huge difference. And what I mean by that is that I think that there are larger forces in American politics that are going to have a bigger outcome or bigger impact on the ultimate outcome in 2018. And those things include President Trump's popularity and the fact that in midterm elections, the party out of power almost automatically, it's been very consistent throughout American history, has some gains in Congress. And I think those two things, the fact that Trump's popularity is quite low, if that continues, and the fact that out of power parties tend to do well in the mid-year elections, well, those two things, I think, are going to ultimately outweigh the specific impact of the tax bill.
A lot of Republican leaders who at some points have had President Trump at arm's length said a lot of nice stuff about him and the release after the passage of this bill and in speeches. Here's Senate Majority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell speaking yesterday.
Well, let me just say, Mr. President, you made the case for the tax bill, but this has been a year of extraordinary accomplishment for the Trump administration. We've cemented the Supreme Court right of center for a generation. Mr. President, thanks to your nominees, we put 12 circuit court judges in place, the most since the circuit court system was established in 1891. You hold the record. You've ended the overregulation of the American economy. And that, coupled with what we did last night and what the House finished this morning, means America is going to start growing again. Thank you, Mr. President, for all you're doing.
So, a president, again, with low approval ratings going into the midterm, and Republican leadership seems to be attaching themselves to him in many ways.
Yeah, and I think ultimately it's because they realize that much of their success, so, I mean, Mitch McConnell in the Senate, Paul Ryan in the House, a lot of it's going to depend on President Trump's popularity. And if he maintains his current, you know, mid-30s popularity into the midterms, it's not going to go well for the Republicans, regardless of the efforts that McConnell and Ryan tried to make or any individual member makes in their own election. So I think part of this move is to try to emphasize as much as they can, well, we had a big win here with tax reform. Maybe we're going to get some more wins in 2018, and try to frame the Trump presidency not as a failure, of course, but as one that has seen some accomplishment. So I think that's going to be the argument that you're going to see from a lot of Republicans, realizing that, well, how Trump goes, their own elections are going to go.
We're talking to Paul Nolet, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. We're looking at the political fallout from the tax plan that just passed Congress. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Are you happy with this tax plan passing? Why or why not? Does it make you more or less likely to vote Republican in 2018? Will the tax plan's approval affect, you think, how things go in Wisconsin, other states around the country in those midterm elections? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation with Paul Nolet, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. We're looking at the political outcome of the tax plan passed yesterday by Congress. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to that plan? Do you see it as a win for Republicans or something that's going to hurt them in the long run? And do you see a benefit to yourself? Do you like this plan? Do you not? Does it change the way you vote? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Before we go to our callers, Paul, people are watching for signs of potential Democratic wave. You mentioned some of the, you know, they're the outside party in a midterm election. That helps. People are looking at places like Virginia, Alabama, elsewhere, where Democrats are winning, where they've lost before. When they're still losing, they're losing by less. What are you watching for when you're trying to figure out if there's going to be a wave election this year or next year?
Well, I think there's a couple of big things that you can look at. One is, well, the actual results of special elections, and to see if that's, if Democrats are consistently doing better than Republicans in a variety of states. So, I mean, you could look at Alabama and say, well, wow, a Democrat just had a huge win there in Alabama, of all places, one of the most Republican states. But you could respond, well, you know, he was against a very weak opponent in Roy Moore and such. However, if Democrats are consistently doing well in states like Virginia and special elections across the country, like even in Oklahoma and Kansas, which they have been, that's a sign that a wave could happen. And just quickly, one other thing that I'd mention is pollsters like to ask the question, who would you like to see in control of Congress next year, the Democrats or the Republicans? So it's known as the generic ballot. Mm-hmm. And so far, Democrats have been doing very well on that measure. And even a year ahead of the election, that tends to be fairly predictive. So those two things in particular are looking quite good for the Democrats right now.
Let's go to our callers. We've got Ben on the line in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Ben?
Just wanted to say that one of the things that, I mean, there was a lot of, during the debate, it wasn't really debate, during the run-up to the passage of the tax bill, a lot of notification and publicity about the doubling of the
the standard deduction?
The standard deduction, thank you. There was much less publicity given to the fact that the personal exemptions were going to disappear. And last year, that was $4,050 per person. The rough calculations I've done on my taxes is that my taxes will go up next year. The combined property and income taxes, the loss of the exemption, even without including charitable contributions, my taxes will be higher under the new plan.
Ben, thanks for the call. And that will happen to some people, as I understand it, Paul. 80% is supposed to get some kind of tax cut, but some people could end up paying more.
Right. And, I mean, even with 80%, of course, you still have 20% who very well could see an increase in taxes. And like Ben mentioned, okay, you have the personal exemptions that are eliminated. Essentially what that's going to mean is, well, if you take a lot of exemptions or have been taking that because you have a larger family, let's say, then you're likely to be looking at a larger tax bill. And, of course, one other big one that I'd mention as well is the state and local tax deduction, which wasn't completely eliminated, but it was limited in this Republican bill. And I don't think that's going to affect many in Wisconsin as much as it will in states like California and New York and New Jersey that tend to have the highest taxes comparative to other states. But that's another area, I think, along with what Ben identified, of that group of 20% who actually are going to see some tax raises as a result of this legislation. So there's still a pretty substantial number of Americans that have an additional reason not to be happy about the tax plan.
Ben, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Tom on the line in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I heard in the discussion that there is some kind of Medicare cut. First question, is that true, and what type of cut is that? And then secondly, how can they possibly think that that's going to be a popular thing?
Tom, thanks for the call. And as I understand it, Paul, correct me if I'm wrong, raising the deficit as this tax cut might trigger some automatic cuts to programs like Medicare that might be put off for a year by the president waiting until the beginning of 2018 to sign that and give Congress some time to figure out what to do with that. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And so just to be clear, this particular legislation itself does not have any Medicare cuts in it. However, it does, because it does add a substantial amount to the deficit because of the lost revenue from the tax cuts, it is going to trigger these automatic spending cuts in a number of areas, including Medicare. And like you mentioned, one of the reasons why Trump isn't signing it immediately, even though it's on his desk and he's waiting till January, is that'll defer it for another year. So that'll give Congress some more time to try to tackle this issue. But of course, that is not going to be easy.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Paul Nolet from Marquette University, looking at some of the political impact of the new tax overhaul legislation just passed by Congress, waiting till the new year for a signature from President Trump. Let's talk about that deficit angle on this. The Republicans in years past have been, many of them, deficit hawks, not wanting to do changes that increase the deficit. I think everybody agrees that this plan will increase the deficit. There's argument about how much economic boost could defray that. But it is a deficit increaser. Is that something that voters vote on, the deficit?
Typically, no, is the short answer. Mm-hmm. A lot of times criticism about the deficit comes most forcefully, perhaps not surprisingly, from those out of power. So now Democrats pointing out the deficit, and then it was Republicans when Obama was president who were really talking about how the deficit was and the overall debt was increasing rapidly. Generally speaking, on an abstract level, Americans don't like rising deficits and debt. But in reality, it typically does not end up being a huge issue at the polls. There's going to be other things, I think, that are going to have a much bigger impact, including, like I mentioned a couple times already, President Trump's popularity himself. Even though he won't be on the ballot in 2018, that's going to have the primary effect on Republicans down the ballot.
You know, I see parallels with 2010 in some ways. The party in power just passed a really big piece of legislation that's making major changes. It's not popular in the public. The party in power is saying, no, hold on. You're going to love it, whether it was the Affordable Care Act then or this tax cut now. How hard is it from a party in power to dig out from a negative perception of their signature legislation?
It's going to be tough, I think. And particularly for a couple of reasons. One, because Democrats have already done a good job, even before the bill was passed, of framing the bill as a tax giveaway to the rich and such, really emphasizing that 80% going to the wealthiest Americans. And then Republicans as a party have traditionally been seen by many Americans as, well, you know, they're friendly towards corporations and wealthier people. And Republicans might say, well, and part of that is because we're trying to revitalize the economy and such and trying to put more money in the hands of those who are going to create jobs. But I think those two things together, the overall perception of the Republican Party and then the perception of this bill specifically, are both combining to make it really hard for Republicans to say, oh, this is really a middle-class tax bill. And I think it's going to be very difficult for them to really change the perceptions of the bill before 2018.
We go back to our callers now with Tom in Holman. Tom, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
Well, I just think it's this bill is ridiculous, and just what your announcer just said there is what I'm totally believing. I'm not Democrat or Republican, but I am just dumbfounded at how successfully they keep selling this nonsense to the public about creating jobs with a trickle down. It didn't work before, and it never has, and particularly now. And I just want to say, what's wrong with the economy? We came out of the worst recession ever, you know, when Obama took the office and progressed out of that, and we're at 4.1, I believe, unemployment right now.
I want to jump in, Tom, to give Paul a chance to respond there. He's saying the GOP doing a good job of selling their tax plan, but again, and there have been advertisements out for and against this, and as we've been talking about in surveys, maybe they haven't sold it all that well.
Right, and I think that that's right. And, you know, one thing about the economy, too, and I think it's related to what Tom just mentioned, is the economy has been doing pretty well. I mean, it hasn't been gangbusters or anything, but it's been doing pretty well. A lot of corporations, even as this bill was being developed, when they were asked, oh, well, what are you going to do with the money that you get from the corporate tax cuts? Not many of them said, well, we're going to reinvest it into new jobs and such. It might be more, you know, higher dividends and that sort of thing. But those are, I mean, those are things that most Americans are not going to see. So I think ultimately it's a combination of the way that Republicans structured the bill and their really inability to effectively pitch this plan to the American public. It leaves us where we are now, which is with a very unpopular bill that just passed.
And thanks for that call, Tom. Very briefly, Paul, thoughts on Paul Ryan here. This has been something he's been working on for years and years in Congress. He's passed something now. Rumors that he might leave Congress. He's denied that. Your thoughts on what this means for the career of Paul Ryan?
Well, I think it's a big win for him, certainly. This, like you mentioned, this is something that has been on his agenda for some time. Ultimately, I think 2018 is certainly going to be the big part of his legacy. Number one, whether he can get any entitlement reform, which is what he's talking about coming in the next year. And then also what happens in the 2018 elections. I mean, if Democrats do have a wave election and Paul Ryan loses his speakership, then obviously that's going to have an effect on his overall legacy.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Paul Nolet, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. Join us for a look at the tax bill that passed yesterday in Congress and what it means for elections next year. The United States is home to more guns than any other country. It has the most people incarcerated, and many Americans place a premium on personal protection and home security. One of the major reasons for all of that could be fear. Our next guest says that since the early days of the Cold War, fear has done a lot to change the way we live, affecting everything from the architecture of our homes and neighborhoods to our laws about crime and punishment. And despite all the attempts to feel safer, she says, those anxieties haven't gone away. Elaine Tyler May is the Regents Professor of American Studies and History and Chair of the Department of History at the University of Minnesota. Her new book is Fortress America: How We Embraced Fear and Abandoned Democracy. Elaine, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We'll dig into the details of your book a little bit, but embracing fear, abandoning democracy. Can you talk about how that's working in America in 2017?
Well, this has a very long history, mm-hmm. and we often think that this kind of obsession with security has popped up since 9/11, and that before that time, Americans were a little bit oblivious to dangers that may or may not have faced them, but weren't as preoccupied. In fact, Americans have been preoccupied with fear, and particularly fear of personal harm, harm to their bodies, and harm from far away, as well as harm from very close by, from strangers, from others, from people they don't know. And it was really the early Cold War era that set the tone for this particular kind of fear. And there were two aspects to it. One was fear that the Soviet Union was going to launch a nuclear attack on the United States, and that if you happened to be in the path of that bomb, there was really nothing that the government could do to protect you. There was only self-protection. And so the government was very busy, and the civil defense authorities were very busy trying to help Americans understand the danger and help them figure out what they could do to protect themselves, because there really wasn't anything that the nation's leaders could do. And as a result, they were both socialized and and in a way led to understand that danger was ever present and could hit at any moment. And at the same time that self-sufficiency and independence and self-reliance and a focus on the family, all of these traditional American virtues, were the best way to protect yourself in the event of an attack. The second piece of this was that there were internal enemies, internal dangers, and these were communists who were supposedly in cahoots with leaders in the Soviet Union and sending secrets and undermining American values, indoctrinating children. And the fear of communists was completely out of proportion to the reality of communism in America, which is that American communists have never been particularly strong, never been a large group, and have largely been more or less interested in progressive politics in the United States. So that fear was also way out of proportion. Now, it's true that in the event of a nuclear attack, that was a real danger. Mm-hmm. And it's also true that all of the civil defense advice that citizens received from the government was really useless. And citizens knew that. They knew that if they built a shelter in their basement, that wasn't going to protect them from the effects of a nuclear bomb, that diving under their desks at school wasn't going to protect children from the effects of a nuclear bomb. They knew that these were what later scholars have called security theater. They were meant to reassure that there was something you could do. But in fact, those things really just increased fear because it was really obvious there was nothing that anyone could do and that the danger was ever present.
But you write that we, even though we maybe knew it wasn't going to work, we did it. We built these bunker-style homes with what we thought were maybe bomb shelters. And you write, this is a theme you keep coming back to, we withdraw inward into our home fortress and out of the public sphere.
Exactly. Now, the number of actual fallout shelters that were built in the U.S. was pretty small. But that mentality that you just described was very true, and it began to affect the way people lived their lives on a day-to-day basis, beginning with a kind of inward focus on the home, a sense of the need for privacy, to be cut off from your neighbors, to be cut off from people who you might suspect might be, you know, interested in doing you harm. Now, the odd thing about that is that that particular kind of fear transcended the atomic age and Cold War fears of communism. And what happened was the idea of ever-present danger began to shift into a fear of crime and social unrest. And that's when it came to have a particularly raw domestic focus, particularly in the sense that in the 1960s and onward, as we began to get a lot of social movements for, you know, equality, the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, etc., that these were movements that unsettled people and made them feel that they were even more vulnerable. As women entered the public realm in greater numbers, as African Americans also achieved greater levels of legal equality and more opportunities for work and employment in various occupations, the sense that there was a change that was potentially dangerous at a time of perceptions of rising crime kind of all came together to heighten this sense of fear and shift those very present fears of constant danger from strangers.
We're talking to Elaine Tyler May. Her new book is Fortress America, How We Embraced Fear and Abandoned Democracy. And you write in the book that fear of crime, that personal fear of crime, entered into popular culture, including the Death Wish movies with Charles Bronson. Here's a moment in the first installment where Bronson's character is getting schooled on the benefits of owning a firearm.
This is gun country. Can you own a handgun in New York City? Out here, I hardly know a man that doesn't own one. And I'll tell you something, unlike your city, we can walk our streets and through our parks at night and feel safe.
That was in the movies, and you're right, that was in the politics. Can we walk our streets? Can we feel safe? Can we protect ourselves?
Right. And that's a great example, because what's so interesting about all of this, the push for guns, the push for locks on the doors, the push for women to stay off the streets because they're dangerous and strangers are always on the lookout to attack. The truth of the matter is the home is the most dangerous place for American citizens. Most violent crimes that take place in this country take place within the home by relatives or personal acquaintances. And this message that you're safest at home and that the real danger facing you is stranger danger has never been true. It just has never been true. And yet that is how danger has been cast, largely by political leaders and by the media, because it's a way of gaining a measure of authority. And also, you know, certainly for the media, a way of gaining listeners or readers, and for political candidates, a way of getting votes. You scare the public, and then you say, we can fix it for you. I am a law and order candidate. I am going to create, you know, stricter laws. We're going to put more people in prison. We're going to crack down on crime. And those messages have been effective. Have they made anyone safer? Not at all. They've led to an overcrowding of our prisons with people who shouldn't be there, particularly African Americans. You know, we have a huge crisis of mass incarceration, and we can really trace that back to this fear-mongering that's been going on since the 1960s. And even more to the point, as violent crime has actually diminished over the last several decades, fear of crime has gone up, which just shows you that there's a disconnect between the reality of the situation and people's own fears.
And I want to talk about that point. You write about that difference between crime statistics and perception of crime statistics. Here's a listen to former House Speaker Newt Gingrich talking at last year's Republican National Convention, talking here with CNN's Allison Camerota about crime rates in the U.S.
The average American, I will bet you this morning, does not think crime is down, does not think they are safer.
But we are safer, and it is down.
No, that's your view. What I said is also a fact. The average American feels when you can walk into a nightclub and get killed, when you can go to a party in a county government building and get killed, people don't think that their government's protecting them.
And there's that distinction. And as you say, crime numbers, though, in overall, they've gone up a little. Violent crime in the United States over the last couple of years, still very low compared, say, to the 80s and 90s. But as Newt Gingrich says, the average American doesn't feel that.
Right. And Gingrich there is saying that the average American is correct to be afraid, whereas, in fact, the likelihood of dying or being harmed in one of these terrible, and they are terrible, these terrible mass shootings is really very, very low compared to the possibility of being harmed within your own home and by people that you know. And we really don't understand that the fear of strangers has been drummed into us for decades.
We're talking to Elaine Tyler May, professor of American Studies and History at the University of Minnesota. Her new book is called Fortress America: How We Embraced Fear and Abandoned Democracy. She writes that fear in a lot of ways has shaped our modern American life, our neighborhoods, our politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think American society is too fearful? Do you see fear or distrust affecting even the social fabric of your neighborhood? Are there things that you're fearful of where you live? Do we put too much emphasis on our concern that a stranger will do us harm? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Historian Elaine Tyler May stays with us. Her new book is Fortress America: How We Embraced Fear and Abandoned Democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we are in America too fearful, too worried about crime, out of proportion to the reality of crime? Are we locking up too many people? And does this affect your life? Does it affect decisions like whether or not to own a firearm, to have a home security system, the neighborhood you live in? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Doug is with us in Stevens Point. Doug, hi.
Hi. I actually was just thinking about a second thing. So I got two things. One, when I was a kid, I was born in the early 80s. My parents told me, stay away from strangers. Strangers are dangerous. You know, be careful of anybody that's got candy in a van and that sort of thing. And I didn't know if that had an effect on us as adults, since we were taught that as children. And the other thing is, everybody is hooked into social media, where a ton of hateful and fearful things are spread all over the place. People are constantly hooked into that. How do you get away from it?
Doug, thanks. Two interesting questions there. We were brought up, I was too to a certain extent, Elaine, worry about strangers. Is that affecting us now as grown-ups?
Well, I think it is, and thank you, Doug. Those are two really, really good and interesting questions. One of the interesting things about how we are raised as children, I think that the story of don't talk to strangers and don't go into somebody's car because they're offering you candy, those kinds of messages have been around for a very long time. What is relatively new, and I think is an effect of the increasing level of fear, is the way that children are now followed around and watched by their parents or their friends' parents. There's very little, bye, Mom, I'm going out to play. Okay, come back at dinner time. And the kid goes off and plays around in the neighborhood with friends and then comes back for dinner. That kind of what is now known as free-range children, I find it a strange but interesting term, has now become very rare and is an answer or a alternative to the way in which children are often monitored, which is the other term is the helicopter parenting. So you have these two kinds of views of parenting, and many parents today admit, and it's so interesting because there have been studies that have actually interviewed parents today, and they say, I had much more freedom when I was a child to just roam around, to ride my bike to school, to go out and play with my friends, and now I don't allow my children to do the very things that I did as a child. And the reason is they feel that the world is more dangerous. In fact, it really isn't. And that's what's kind of tragic about this, because it's inhibiting children's ability to be really independent and to grow up feeling strong and secure with a sense that they have their own strength and their own intuition about the world they live in.
And to his other point about social media, and I think, 24-hour media access in general, in the old days, something bad happened somewhere, you read about it maybe the next day in the newspaper, you saw it once in the evening news. Now you have the potential, we have the potential to obsess over it, follow it, get every bit of detail about that we can. It's going to loom larger in our minds.
Yes, absolutely. And this has also increased. The media has always focused on the rare and heinous crimes. That's not new in itself. The adage that if it bleeds, it leads, that those things sell newspapers, they bring more viewers to television news programs. But it has gotten a lot worse with the proliferation of first cable news. And now, as Doug pointed out, social media has really heightened this. So our ways of communicating with each other, rather than making us more trusting of each other and creating more bonds as a society for the common good, it's made us more afraid of each other, and that's really tragic.
Thanks a lot for that call, Doug. We're talking to Elaine Tyler May from the University of Minnesota. Her new book is Fortress America, How We Embraced Fear and Abandoned Democracy. Back to your calls now. Abraham is with us in Green Bay. Abraham, hi.
Hi. I wanted to, give an example of something that the guest brought up and also then ask a follow-up question. The example is the guest earlier said that the politicians in our country beat the drums and paint bleak pictures of the country and then tell us that they are men or women of the law, mostly men, though. Proposes fixes for us. An example of this is our current president. Throughout his campaign, specifically on his inaugural speech, he painted this bleak picture of the country, that anybody who hadn't lived here, who hadn't known anything about, would most certainly try to stay the heck away from.
And I want to give a listen, Abraham, to a clip of that inaugural address from President Trump.
And the crime and the gangs and the drugs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
Elaine Abraham was pointing to that speech, and American carnage definitely got a lot of attention. Your thoughts?
Well, yes, and Abraham, thanks for that observation and that question. It's not new. I think that the first major national presidential election to focus overwhelmingly on street crime and law and order was actually 1968. That's how far back it goes. And so there are lots of precedents. I agree that Trump actually made this a much louder drumbeat. He knew this was an issue that could get a lot of emotion on the part of his listeners, and he was obviously inciting fear, because the more people are afraid, the more they can be controlled by people, leaders who say, I've got the solution, I'm going to fix it all. Now, it's also true that the Democrats, as well as the Republicans, have used law and order as campaign issues, but the way in which this issue has increased is quite striking, especially in light of the fact that violent crime has decreased since the 1990s quite dramatically. And so what we hear in Trump's address there that was just played is really addressing something that isn't actually reflecting the reality of the country that we are living in today, and it serves to further drive us away from each other, to drive citizen from citizen and neighbor from neighbor and people of different races and backgrounds from each other. And that's very damaging. It damages our democracy. The only way we can have a thriving democracy is through trust and a belief in the common good.
And I want to, we just have a minute and a half left or so, Elaine, I want to get into that point a little further. People have talked over the years about the public sphere being necessary for a thriving democracy, a civic forum where people can engage with each other. If we're retreating into our homes, if we're in fear, we're afraid to talk to the other people on the streets, what does that do for democracy?
Well, it really destroys it, frankly. It really diminishes our ability to function as a working democracy. And that is truly tragic. And it is certainly my hope that the country is beginning to wake up to that fact and come together to reclaim the country that relies on trusting one another, on believing that the common good is important, believing that we have to protect and sustain our democracy, believing that the government represents us, is not our enemy, but is actually our representation to fulfill the will of the people. And we have a long way to go to get there, but I'm a hopeful person. In spite of the dismal book that I wrote, I am hopeful, and my book ends on the note of hope that Americans will wake up, realize that democracy is actually being threatened, and will come together to reclaim it.
Elaine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
That's Elaine Tyler May. She's a professor of American Studies and History at the University of Minnesota. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Fortress America: How We Embraced Fear and Abandoned Democracy.